It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Good morning and welcome to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Good morning, Casey.
Good morning, Kirk, and welcome back.
Thank you.
Kirk is back on the show, and it's always good to have him for our bantering and everything else that goes on.
That way you don't have to argue with yourself.
Exactly. It can be difficult to argue with yourself. So, Kirk, a lot of stuff happened while you were away, but including this really interesting topic that I wanted to save just to talk with you.
Oh, I see.
Wisconsin is weighing in on a North Carolina traffic stop case at the United States Supreme Court. In this story from the Journal Sentinel, Wisconsin Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen announced that his office had filed a brief in a North Carolina case pending at the U.S. Supreme Court over a traffic stop based on a broken taillight. State prosecutors just lost a similar case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, but say that they support North Carolina's claim that a stop should not violate the Fourth Amendment if officers were objectively reasonable, even if mistaken, about the legality of a partially broken taillight. Law enforcement officials rely heavily on such equipment infractions to stop motorists, who then often consent to searches of their vehicles where their officers find evidence of crimes. Civil libertarians say a softened standard for legal traffic stops could lead to abuses and harassment of innocent drivers. Van Hollen's announcement said 18 other states and the District of Columbia signed on to Wisconsin's amicus brief in the case, Hyen versus North Carolina. The case is set for oral argument before the U.S. Supreme Court in October, and it all stems from this case. In 2010, a sheriff's deputy stopped a car on the interstate because it only had one brake light, and the backseat passenger, the defendant in this case, was later charged with possessing cocaine that the deputy had found in the car during a consensual search. The defendant later argued to suppress the evidence because North Carolina law only requires one working brake light, and traditionally, a mistake of law does not support law enforcement's claim of probable cause to make a stop. North Carolina Appeals Court agreed, but the state's Supreme Court reversed, adopting the reasonable standard urged by Van Hollen. Now, earlier this month in Wisconsin, the Wisconsin Supreme Court voted in a close vote, 4-3, to reverse a gun conviction that started with a traffic stop based on what the court agreed was a mistaken understanding of the law. In that case, the defendant was a passenger in a 1977 Buick that had several bulbs in a wide taillight array. The fact that a single bulb was out did not make the taillight defective under the law, the majority found. So, this is really interesting, but it does give... I think if they adopt this objectively reasonable, even if mistaken under the law standard, that would, you know, right now police officers can stop you for just about anything.
Right.
I mean, if you're an officer and you can't find a reason to stop somebody's vehicle, a legal reason to stop somebody's vehicle, you know, you're going 1 mile per hour over the speed limit, 1 mile per hour under the speed limit. Yeah. You don't turn your turn signal on in time, anything. You know,
well, look,
let's
be clear here. The trend here over the past, I would say, 20 years or so has been to increase the number of citizen contacts for a variety of reasons, some legitimate and some probably not. But little known fact is that many police departments, although not all, have their promotion systems as well as their pay systems set up in such a way so that officers are gauged by their number of self-initiated citizen contacts, meaning they're not being dispatched out to a particular location, but they see something, they initiate a contact, and then it goes from there. Excuse me. But a lot of people would say that aren't familiar with the law or are not familiar with how the Fourth Amendment works and the suppression remedy, which is there as a remedial measure to make sure that law enforcement officers don't cross that line of where the Fourth Amendment stands. Fourth Amendment, of course, being that portion of our Bill of Rights that guarantees all of us, whether you're doing something wrong or not, against an unreasonable search and seizure, unless there's a warrant or if there is probable cause that can be articulated. So this is really what the issue comes down to, is that when an officer is out on patrol, sees something, would like to pull the car over, And in this particular scenario where the officer believes that he or she understands what the law is as it relates to an equipment violation, but is wrong, can that officer then initiate a stop and gather evidence and so forth? So a lot of people would think, well, hey, this guy had cocaine in his car, so what's the big deal? But, you know, it impacts every single stop if you're talking about the standard for which an officer must have in his or her own mind as far as what's going on. The problem here, as you've correctly pointed out, Casey, is, you know, you're going to save that little clip. You know, every time I say that you correctly point something out, I guess it goes in the archive.
I've got them in a bin somewhere.
Yeah, a bin someplace. Yeah. It says, you know, you can just play them all in a row.
Yeah.
You know, fortunately, it's not all that often. But, you know, you're correct in the sense that there's a slippery slope here when we're talking about an officer coming up with a reason. And to say that, you know, an objectively reasonable yet mistaken standard, first of all, that's pretty much no standard, because how can you be wrong about the law but objectively reasonably wrong about the law is really the issue. So you would think that if an officer is charged with the responsibility of determining whether somebody is or isn't breaking the law, and we're not talking about somebody clearly, you know, speeding or hitting cars or evading or eluding or throwing trash out the window or anything that right. you or I or anybody else in the world would know is a violation of law and a reason to pull somebody over.
Yeah.
But we're talking about something that is not against the law.
Well,
and the officer then determines, however that happens in an officer's mind, that, well, I may be wrong, but I'm objectively reasonably wrong.
Yeah, and
that
I don't
really
know.
Doesn't make any sense. It's not a workable standard. What they're trying to do here is make it so any reason is a reason. And there are those that would say that's fine because, you know, really what this comes down to, and this has to do with, you know, deterring drunk driving, deterring illegal behavior, the safety of the public and so forth, which are all legitimate and important goals. But the mechanism by which law enforcement has increased contact with the citizenry is really the issue here, because it ends up being a situation where an officer doesn't really have to have much of a reason at all.
That's right. And, you know, Kirk, in this, I just go back to think about it. Let's say that somebody came into court. Let's say somebody who was charged with a crime came into court and they said, you know, I thought this is what the law was, but I was just wrong about it.
Well, ignorance of the law is no excuse.
We know that, right? Isn't that the biggest thing that we so ignorance of the law is no excuse when it applies to somebody.
Out of the two people, the officer driving his or her car,
who's in law enforcement,
and the citizen who's driving his or her car, who should be tasked with knowing what the law is?
Right.
I would think the officer.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, we say both.
Right.
But right now, what we're saying is, well, the person driving the car. But also,
so how can we turn this on its head? You know, if any of our clients said, you know, bank robbery, I had no idea that was against the law. And if it was somehow objectively reasonable under the circumstances, that could amount to a defense, right?
Well, let me give you an example.
Okay.
Let's say somebody who, and this is, I think, objectively reasonable, but it's certainly against the law and nobody should do it. Let's say that somebody was convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence. And there's a definition, it's a technical term, and they thought that they would be able to own or possess a firearm. But in fact, they couldn't own or possess a firearm
right.
because of the conviction that they had. And they went out and did that, and they ended up getting in trouble for it because they couldn't do it.
Well, when that happens, they cannot raise the defense of, I didn't know.
Exactly.
That's not allowed.
And even though it's a technical thing, even though it's hard for even lawyers to understand exactly what constitutes a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, there's all kinds of
litigation. And you would think it's very simple, but it's not.
It's not very simple, yeah. But you would think so. But, you know, but we are tasking citizens with being able to know that. But yet now we're saying officers who are trained in law, who know what they're doing, who, you know, presumably know the law, it's okay if they're wrong about the law and they stop somebody and they end up charging that person with a crime, as long as they were objectively reasonable. Now, Wisconsin has not taken this approach. Wisconsin just voted 4-3 against this approach
right.
to uphold the law as it was in State versus Longcore, which is a case that basically says if you're wrong about the law, a mistake of law
cannot be probable cause.
Cannot be probable cause. A mistake of fact can be.
Yeah.
But a mistake of law cannot be. So Now they're trying to
Let me give you another example, because this is pretty common. You know what the law says with regard to window tinting?
Yes.
Or another similar subject matter would be what constitutes a loud exhaust. Okay.
Right.
Both of those areas, there is a standard, but it's very difficult to employ in the field, because you have to actually be close enough to the car and in some cases measure the tint or the audible output of the vehicle. And how do you do that other than stopping the vehicle? So we've got a whole category of law enforcement interactions that fall in the realm of investigatory stops. And this is where we have a problem with the overlap, because if an officer is allowed to investigate whether or not a crime or violation of law is being committed, this is where you can see them kind of piggybacking that issue on top of, well, I didn't really know if this person was violating the equipment law because they had one bulb missing, and not knowing whether or not that constitutes a, you know, an equipment violation, but pulls the person over to get a closer look or to, you know, have some kind of contact with the citizen. Then we have the issue of, and this actually has been upheld in different contexts, but let's say, for example, the officer observes that there is a bulb that's not illuminated, but there are enough bulbs that make it so the brake lights work or the running lights work and meet the definition of working taillights or working brake lights. Theoretically, the officer could pull the person over just to let them know, by the way, you might want to get your bulb replaced. You know, and if that was fell in the category of, you know, public servant, you know, the helpful officer that says, gee, I thought you might like to know that if you want to get this bulb replaced, you could do that because I observed it and you might not know about it. And that's a problem, you know, when we start expanding things into those territories where, you know, virtually anything at all, like, hey, did you know that there's, you know, you could use a new paint job on your car? Or did you know that, you know, one of the stickers on the back of your car is starting to peel off or something like that?
Right. That could lead to abuses.
Yeah. Or let's say, you know, we just did a story not too long ago about the people that have their entire family and stick figures on the back. Let's say the officer pulls them over and says, you know, people can use that information to commit crimes against
you. There you go.
So then all of a sudden the person's arrested for something else.
Very good tie-in. All right, Kirk, we got to take a break. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
Now back to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. This is actually a very sad story all around. There was the death of this woman based on this Lutheran bishop who was driving, presumably or allegedly drunk, when he hit this woman on the side of the road.
It's not allegedly anymore because
he's
convicted.
Well, not allegedly. Yeah. He was convicted. That's true. Bruce Burnside, the former Lutheran bishop, this is from the Wisconsin State Journal, convicted of hitting and killing a female runner while driving drunk, was sentenced Thursday, just a couple days ago, to 10 years in prison, two-thirds of the maximum possible sentence. Burnside, 60 years old, also will serve 5 additional years on extended supervision for the death of Maureen Mengelt, 52 years old, who police say was thrown 69 feet by the force of Burnside's SUV. The sentence came late Thursday afternoon after a nearly 8-hour emotional hearing at which numerous family members and friends spoke on behalf of the defendant and the victim. Burnside spoke for nearly 30 minutes, his first public comment since the crash 15 months ago. He said he accepted sole responsibility for what happened and felt great remorse, but he continued to assert that he did not flee the scene of the crash or realize that he was too impaired by alcohol to drive. The judge rejected the credibility of those assertions. Burnside's family declined to comment after the sentencing, many left in shock and in tears. The victim's husband, who had sought the maximum term of 15 years, called McNamara's sentence reasonable and well thought out. He had pleaded guilty back in May to second-degree reckless homicide, which is a felony. He was driving to an afternoon church event when he lost control of his vehicle on a highway exit ramp and hit the woman, who was out for a Sunday trail run, or training run, rather. Police first spoke with him at a nearby gas station. A preliminary breath test showed that he had a BAC of 0.128. He was charged with four felonies and one misdemeanor. The charges included felony homicide by intoxicated use of a vehicle and felony hit and run involving death. Under a plea agreement, he was convicted of the reckless homicide charge and also pleaded guilty to first offense drunk driving. So this was gets interesting for a number of different reasons, but the assistant district attorney spoke for nearly 90 minutes in very good detail about what happened in this incident. And what I found interesting is that the method of his communication, they said that he had been texting the entire time while he was driving from Madison to Sun Prairie. So Madison, Sun Prairie, you know, 20 minutes,
right,
depending on where you are. But the method was voice texting. So he was using his cell phone to voice text. So if you don't know what that is, basically...
Which I believe you're allowed to do. That's not against the law.
Well, they're saying it is.
Okay.
That's what the prosecutor said
it is. It's a little bit of a gray area.
Yeah. And as it wasn't thumb texting, but it was voice texting. But you're right. I think but the prosecutor said the law makes no distinction between the two, as both are illegal and distract the driver. That was her argument.
Just a little sidebar here. I was in Los Angeles for a few days last week, and the law there is you cannot use a cell phone at all, period.
Right.
You can't even have it in your hand,
right,
while you're driving. And I can't say that the drivers were significantly better in controlling their vehicles, you know, in L.A. It's hard to tell, though, because you're going about 3 miles an hour everywhere you go. But, you know, I would support that law. I don't know how you feel about that, but I would honestly...
If there was no cell phone at all?
Because it's a clear standard. But here we have the question, you know, I know the law. We've even talked about it on the show, about the texting law and what the purpose behind it is.
And
the exceptions to it.
Whether you can send or receive emails, whether you can read your emails.
Yeah, because the way the law is written, it talks about texting. Now, technically, right, I suppose you are texting if you talk at your phone. But that requires pressing one button and then maybe two.
But then also reading the text to make sure that you're not that the Siri or whoever's talking on your phone isn't making anything up that's different.
Correct. There's that.
It's like, Kirk, I'm coming to work today, versus Kirk, I'm not coming to work today.
Right.
Kirk, I'm going to the bar today instead of going to work. You know, you
can
do
check
all
to
kinds
make sure
of
it's
crazy
okay.
things
right,
with yourself.
Right,
so
right.
You're reading it.
But the point, there's also the fact that there is no prohibition. In fact, there's a specific exception in Wisconsin that you can manipulate your cell phone for the purpose of utilizing a GPS or something like that. Not true in California. I mean, you really cannot have a phone for any use.
Even emergency
behind
use?
The wheel. Well, there is an exception to that, but you're not supposed to be moving, is the point. And so it was interesting because I didn't see anybody using their phones in their car.
What if you're driving, your wife's going into labor?
Yeah.
And you need
to
call.
Well, that would be like breaking any law that you need to out of necessity, and you might just have to get a ticket for it. You know, like if your wife's in labor and you have to exceed the speed limit for some reason, get the ticket, you know, because you had to get your wife to the hospital.
Just take the ticket.
But
it's going to take more time when you get pulled over. I'm sorry.
It's my fault because I took us off track. But
no,
let me just comment on a couple of things, and we can get back to your story. But essentially, the big issue here is that. And one thing I caught that was very significant about this story is that if his preliminary breath test indicates an alcohol level of approximately 0.12. Mm-hmm. Now, first of all, we have to bear in mind that preliminary breath tests are not necessarily accurate, but they do tend to give you a rough estimate of where a person's alcohol concentration is. And I'll point this out. 0.12 is at that level where it's very common that someone with that amount of alcohol in their system would not be aware of their own impairment. And if you look at some of the studies that have been done that show when a person becomes cognizant or capable of understanding their level of impairment, independent of how much they've had to drink. I'm just talking about your own self-assessment of if you've had too much to drink. It's a classic scenario that someone gets behind the wheel where they are legally drunk but do not feel that it's unsafe to drive because of their own self-assessment. And, you know, I bring this up all the time, so I'm going to do it again. You can reach across the studio and slap me across the face if you want to.
I
give you permission. But it's a debate that's raging throughout the country right now, is that how are we going to accommodate the legalization or decriminalization of marijuana in those states that allow it for recreational use and combine that with the laws that we have to prevent impaired driving. And study upon study that have been coming out lately, because the government, of course, wants to know more data about this issue. It's been an underrepresented area in the literature that's out there. But it is generally understood that although impairment by marijuana is a dangerous thing, and it certainly is, a person who is impaired by marijuana, because of the type of impairment and because of the effects on that person, tends to be more aware of that impairment and is capable of conforming their behavior to match the law, much more so than alcohol-related impairment. Now, put in other words, someone who's high from marijuana knows that they're high when they're high. Someone who's drunk from alcohol, like our good bishop here, at a 1-2, which is far above the legal limit of 0.08, would not necessarily, just this is just based on normal human physiology,
right,
would not be aware that there's an impairment level that actually impacts his ability to safely control the motor vehicle.
Well, and in this tragic case, you know, you have that combined with the voice texting,
right,
and that, you know, that can complicate things, because also the one thing that was revealed in court on Thursday is that just 2 hours before the crash, Burnside, the defendant, texted someone that he was sitting in his backyard with, quote, my laptop and a Bloody Mary, end quote. And this suggests that Burnside wasn't telling the truth when he said earlier that he had not been drinking since the night before. Or early morning hours.
Maybe this was a very big Bloody Mary that lasted for, you know, 6 hours.
Perhaps.
That he made the night before, and it was just bleeding into the next day.
Perhaps.
No pun intended.
Right, exactly. And you know, and so this entire situation is interesting because it's one of the first cases that I've seen anyway of, I mean, I don't know, have you seen any other cases of voice texting while driving being partially the cause, at least, for an accident in Wisconsin?
No, I haven't, but I'm sure it's happened.
Yeah. And I mean, a homicide. You know.
Well, right. I mean, that does tend to be the focus of, well, let's peel it back a couple of layers. What's the point of the law? The law is don't be distracted by something that's dividing your attention away from the roadway.
Yeah.
You know, but especially when you're operating a ton and a half missile that's going down the road, you know, at 65 miles an hour, you should be careful about what you're doing because it's a very dangerous piece of machinery. So don't be texting people about this, that, or the other thing. And it gives us some guidance on being careful. So
yeah, and we have more distractions now than ever in our cars.
Yeah.
I mean, when it comes to GPS units, I know that at least my GPS unit that I have, that's my external one anyway, is you can manipulate it while you're driving.
Right.
Some of them actually don't work while you're driving. They've, I think, put that into place for safety reasons. But, you know, our radios are more
more.
I mean, people hooking up their MP3 players and their iPods
and
all kinds of stuff. Plugging into the cigarette lighter now to charge your phone or whatever. Do they even have cigarette lighters in cars anymore?
I don't think so.
I mean, it's kind of, maybe.
They have those little slots that you can put something in, so I suppose that you could fit one in there.
It could be, yeah.
Yeah.
They don't
pump standard. You know, what about the fact that, what about accessing a good old-fashioned map? You know, a piece of paper that is designed. I mean, the reason that maps are made, you know, those gazetteers that you can get, which are awesome, by the way. I have one in my car. But if you want to do it the old-fashioned way, where you're looking at an actual map, you know, is there a law that says you can't look at a map while you're in your moving vehicle?
Or you call that,
that's a whole lot more complicated.
Yeah, that's a lot
texting.
More complicated. Or you call your friend Rand McNally. Isn't that his name?
Yeah, Rand.
I forget.
Good old Rand.
He's a good guy.
Yeah.
All right, we got to take a break. This is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
It's Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
And welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey.
And I'm Kirk.
All right, Kirk. There's a story about sex offenders in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel that talks about these ordinances that restrict sex offenders from living in certain places. Milwaukee and Madison, it seems, have been sort of places that haven't traditionally regulated that type of thing as much.
Well, it would be hard to do, but go ahead.
Right. It would be hard to do, but they they find that they have sort of more sex offenders living in their areas or people convicted of sex crimes than others. So Milwaukee's city limits, this according to the Journal Sentinel, are now largely off limits to designated sex offenders who are required to register with the state for serious offenses. Mayor Tom Barrett, this past Monday, signed legislation narrowly approved by the Common Council last week that restricts residency for convicted sex offenders. Milwaukee becomes the 15th municipality in Milwaukee County out of 19 total municipalities that have such a restriction. Hales Corners, River Hills, Shorewood, Whitefish Bay are the only communities that do not have a residency restriction ordinance. In an interview, Barrett said it was clear to him that the State Department of Corrections was placing more offenders in the city, quote, while other municipalities keep them out, end quote. City officials estimate that at least 80% or more of the sex offenders living in Milwaukee County reside in the city of Milwaukee. Barrett said he spoke with the police chief about his decision. Top police officials had raised concerns that the new ordinance would make it more difficult for police to monitor serious sex offenders. The individuals being placed in our city have committed state crimes, Barrett said. They have been prosecuted by state prosecutors and tried before state judges. The state can no longer wash its hands of them. In a letter Barrett sent Monday to the corrections secretary, the mayor wrote that he signed the measure, quote, due to inaction by state government and negligence by the Department of Corrections. Under the ordinance, certain serious sex offenders cannot establish a permanent or temporary residence within 2,000 feet of any school, licensed daycare center, park, recreational trail, playground, or any other place designated by the city as a place where children are known to congregate.
Is that pretty much everywhere?
It's pretty much everywhere in Milwaukee. It's just about everywhere. And there was no immediate reaction from the Department of Corrections, and they're talking about how this is going to impact public safety. But what does it really do? Isn't this sort of not in my backyard syndrome? And sex offenders have to live somewhere.
Right.
Nobody wants them to live in their own backyards. And so if somebody's convicted of a sex crime, it makes it very, very difficult for them to do anything, to live anywhere.
Well, let's talk anywhere. About the law here, because a lot of people get confused on this issue in that how can you have some sort of post-conviction, post-offense legislation that affects people that are in a particular status. And it does feel wrong, because what if we did it based on race, religion, gender,
right,
something like that? And although, you know, most people would tend to agree that someone who's committed a sex offense does not deserve equal protection in the same way that we do because of our race, religion, or gender. It does feel like that, because we're taking people that are in a particular status.
And who have already served their sentence.
And I'll get to that in a second. But yeah, the point is that because of their status, we're telling them that you can't enjoy the normal life. And I'm not talking about rights. I'm talking about whether you can be part of a community or not. Now, the problem is, as you've already alluded to, jumping the gun there, Mr. Jumpy Guns, is that...
I'm sorry.
That's okay. I accept your apology. But the problem is that the implementation of this is inconsistent with the goals that we have in a modern, advanced, civilized society. Meaning that if we trust our legal system, and we're going to trust it to convict people with a jury of peers based on evidence which is admissible and hasn't violated someone's rights, we trust a jury to make that determination, then a judge to determine what the sentence should be, which not only effectively punishes the person, but also provides adequate rehabilitative needs based on the offense and that person's individual characteristics. There's a whole lot of trust and faith that we put in the people that are part of that machinery that makes things happen. Now, beyond that, beyond the prosecutor and the defense lawyer and the judge that all participate in that process at the front end of the person being convicted, then we have state officials, and you may or may not believe in the effectiveness of government, but I'm just talking about an ideal here. The Department of Corrections is another piece of government machinery that is tasked with some very, you know, challenging issues, and that is, how do you affect the sentence that was given that both takes into account the punitive as well as the rehabilitative aspects? And just so you know, someone who is a convicted sex offender is so completely monitored in terms of their whereabouts, where they're living, what they're doing, who they have a relationship with, what TV shows they watch, whether or not they use a computer. Many of them are on electronic monitoring,
right?
Depending upon the nature of the offense or whatnot. So the point is that these are people that are much more monitored than your average citizen. It's also been demonstrated statistically. And I don't mean statistics like the Mark Twain kind of statistics where
okay.
It's lies, and statistics. I mean simple data gathered in terms of who commits sex offenses. Now, it is true that a very small proportion of previously convicted sex offenders do reoffend. And that's, you know, it's a risk that's out there. But that's why we put so much emphasis on making sure that person has treatment, has monitoring, and they basically have guidance and supervision because the person presumably has a mental condition or, you know, some form of criminality that we believe as a society can be treated.
Right.
Right?
Right.
I mean, that's how we prevent things, is that we treat them. You know, when you go to the doctor when you've got the symptoms of a disease, the doctor will treat those symptoms so that you don't die from it.
Yeah, and this is not popular. And let's not forget, when we talk about sex offenders and somebody who's a registered sex offender, that could theoretically be, and actually would be, if somebody got charged with a felony sexual assault for being, for example, 18 years old or 17 years old even, and had sex with consensual, although not consensual in law, but consensual in fact, sex with, for example, his girlfriend who happened to be
almost 16.
Those things can happen, and that
so the
they get
a difference of 12 months and one day can result in someone being a convicted sex offender,
and then they
for the rest of their lives,
right? They're monitored. They're on the sex offender registry. Are those people really dangerous? Are we going to go into every high school in America? Because these cases are being charged. They're not just
anomalies. It's not just hypothetical.
It's right. not. They are being charged with sex offenses. That, you know, that in combination with, you know, so we're talking about young people having sex sometimes with other young people. And right. why do you think that's right or wrong for them to be categorized as sex offender? Most people think of sex offenders as, and this is, the guy.
Chester the molester, right.
Right, who's taken the little girl off the street and abducting her. And we know that's not how the overwhelming majority of these happen.
Well, not only that, but, and this is, let me finish my statistical point here,
yes.
which is that people who are arrested for sex offenses, generally speaking, the vast majority of offenders have been perpetrated someone they know or are related to.
Right.
It is so infrequent that it's a stranger walking down the street or
stranger danger.
Right. Yeah. And it's extremely infrequent that you have a situation where somebody's prowling a schoolyard. I mean, these are just our fears that are in our head that aren't borne out by facts. Okay. The average person, the majority of people that are arrested for sex offenses have no record at all. And have never been on the radar, and have found themselves in a situation where they've done something very wrong, very much against the law, but they weren't subject to any of these residency requirements.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So where do people go? And again, sex offender, people who are charged with sex crimes, certainly a very unpopular group of people. I mean, we can say that because you and I deal in this legal
sure.
industry, and we know how unpopular people are. I would say in many cases more unpopular than somebody who has murdered somebody.
Right, and it's just one of those categories where, understandably, you know, that's a direction our society has gone in over the course of the past really 100 years,
right,
where we place a higher emphasis on the protection of our children, and that's
and we
fine.
Should.
That's
but,
fine.
But the bottom line is, what do with people who have already served their sentence, who are now out, who are being monitored, as you say, in a very scrutinous fashion, and who now we're saying, well, we don't want them to live here. At some point, there's going to be, if all these communities are doing this, there's going to have to be some type of consensus, because what do you do with people who are convicted of these types of things, including something as, and I'm not saying this is insignificant, but a misdemeanor fourth degree sexual assault, right? You can be
Theoretically, yes.
Ordered
it depends
to be
on
the sex offender registry.
The judge.
It depends
could,
on the judge.
Judge could order that.
Judge
yeah.
could order it if they wanted to. So we're talking about things that are not, necessarily.
Well, here's something else that the general public is not aware of, but there is a statute under Wisconsin law that permits a judge to find somebody not a sex offense, but a category of offense that was quote unquote sexually motivated.
Right.
So it could be a battery, a misdemeanor battery that the judge finds for some reason was sexually motivated. And even though it's not a sex offense, that person becomes a sex offender.
Right.
And has to register and has to comply with sex offender rules. But I think the point we're getting at here, and we're not too far off on our view, is that this is a bad solution to the problem. And the problem is, how do we prevent recidivism, or in other words, how do we stop a sex offender from reoffending? Throwing them out of your neighborhood is not the answer.
Exactly.
Now, most municipalities have a procedure whereby a waiver can be applied for. And Sheboygan has this process. You meet before a committee that's part of the city government, and the person explains where they're going to live, what they're going to be doing, who they're going to be living with. And typically that person's probation agent accompanies that person to such a hearing. And I'm assuming that would have to be part of the process in Milwaukee as well.
I mean, would imagine.
And we're talking about, just by virtue of the fact that we're going to say, let's have this complicated process whereby, first of all, you have to determine if somebody is, within so many feet of a school and all these other things, and that general category of where children tend to congregate. Well, the enforcement of that, it's going to cost us a lot of money. Then all of the meetings and hearings and things for people to say, well, I'm applying for a waiver. In a city that has a very high population,
yes,
this is going to be a fiscal nightmare, I can tell you right now.
It absolutely is. Well, we have to take a break. You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. We'll be back in just a moment.
You're listening to Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey on 1330 WHBL.
Like the folks you meet on, like to plant my feet on the Brooklyn Bridge. What a lovely view from heaven looks at you from the Brooklyn Bridge.
Welcome back to Legal Defense. I'm Casey Hoff.
And I'm Kirk O'Bear. Hey, are we almost done?
We are.
How did that happen?
I don't know. Time flies.
We have so much fun these Saturday mornings.
Yeah, absolutely. It's good to have you back, Kirk.
And, thank you.
And, this is a story that I just thought was a little bit more lighthearted, although many are taking it very seriously in New York. You've heard about the situation with the Brooklyn Bridge?
Yes.
By the way, I
have a good deal for you if you want to buy it.
Oh, the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yes, I've heard that joke before. and you'll like this because this is good writing, too. New York Post. A wacky pro-pot activist. Now, do you think they have any
bias? Now,
wait
a minute. When they say pro-pot and they use the word wacky,
yeah.
That's kind of redundant.
I know. I do. A wacky pro-pot activist claims that he burned New York's finest by planting the notorious white flags on the Brooklyn Bridge, and he swears he's not just hitting the bong too hard. This is actually how it reads.
Yeah.
This is a newspaper.
Yeah.
The Reverend...
Journalism at its finest.
The Reverend Bud Green, 49 years old, said that a group...
Is that his birth name?
I strongly doubt it, although I guess it depends on the parents and what they were thinking at the time and what
they decided. Well, you know Meatloaf, right?
Yes.
That's his real name. His parents did not name him Meatloaf.
No.
They named him Olive Loaf.
Yeah, and then he changed Olive
it.
Loaf.
Yeah, they changed it to Meatloaf.
Not Ham Loaf or anything like
well,
that?
Well, he went through a couple of different loaves in his life, but ended up with meat.
Oh, this is good. Well, the Reverend Bud Green said that a group of anarchists, quote, who do stuff like this for the thrill of it, end quote, emailed him after he posted about a pro-weed blog on the 4th of July asking what they could do to help his cause. The California-based weed booster said that he hatched the plan, but three or four other guys who have backgrounds in climbing carried out the act. He says, and I quote, I came up with the idea. We're trying to shake people up. Nobody else has the balls to do it, said Green, who's a member of the so-called POT Party, which stands for People Opposing Tyranny. Green said that he and his accomplices spoke briefly on the phone to hash out You know, are they using puns in here?
I think so.
Hash out some of the details of the stunt. They decided on
They leave that kind of thing up to us, but they've done it for us in this article.
They've stolen our thunder. Although I guess nobody owns the thunder, they can have it. They decided on the Brooklyn Bridge instead of the Empire State Building because security at the skyscraper was too tight. He waited more than a week to reveal himself because the group at first had planned to climb the bridge a second time and replace the white flags with ones that featured a hemp leaf. We wanted to put together a big media thing. We were hoping that it would fade out after a couple of days, but it really shocked people. On July 22nd, intruders slipped past the NYPD's anti-terror nexus to plant bleached white flags high atop the bridge's 276-foot towers last week. So,
what's the deal with the white flags?
I don't get the deal with the white flags. I really don't understand it.
Yeah. Maybe he missed the point, too.
Yeah, and you know, it does look like it's a bleached-out actual flag, like flag that was actually bleached
out. Okay, well,
out,
let me just point this out.
Which is pretty offensive.
So he's got a message. He's the Reverend Green and all this other stuff. I get it, you know, and he's
Reverend
making political statement and, you know, free speech, blah, blah, blah. But why can't this be done in a manner that doesn't violate other laws? First of all, he's breaking a very sacred law, which is the... destruction or
flag desecration.
Flag desecration, right. Yeah. Right. Which, and this isn't burning the flag. I mean, it's probably legal in terms of free speech and all the litigation that's gone on there in terms of whether you're allowed to burn a flag.
Yeah, you can burn a flag.
You can do that. Yeah. And I guess you can bleach one too. But,
but it is desecrating the flag.
It is desecrating, and it's also, I would argue, illegal to display a flag that has been altered. Okay. I think there is a provision under federal law that, be, you know, like if you took some of the stars off, or you added some extra ones, or maybe the stripes were the wrong, whatever.
Yeah.
But you know, it's kind of a vague statute as
but
far as that goes.
But climbing on top of the Brooklyn Bridge.
But that's the problem, right? 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 I mean, there are many ways that our founders envisioned that people would be able to exercise their free speech in a civil way that draws significant enough attention, all the attention you need to your cause, to educate people without looking like a freak. Okay? And people are allowed to look like freaks. It's just that when you start breaking laws by climbing up on the Brooklyn Bridge and then testing the anti-terrorism network and whether or not they can stop you from doing it, and it's a combination of embarrassing the government by breaking some law, just like the people that parachuted off the Freedom Tower. It's very, you know, the free speech element gets put out there because it's broadcast all over the country. But that in and of itself, and I don't really have a problem with the message. I'm just saying, the only reason this guy's getting attention now, and it's completely missed the content of the message. Does anybody care about marijuana after reading this article? They just think the guy's nuts.
Yeah, and they're angry at him and they get mad at him. I think when you were gone during this when this happened, but did you hear about the gentleman who climbed up and bungee jumped off of the Acuity flag area right here in Sheboygan?
I did hear about it.
Yeah, and he actually put it on YouTube or posted the video on YouTube, and apparently he's done this in other places, such as on a bridge in Green Bay.
I was gone, so I didn't get the details. But how did he get up there?
I don't know. I still don't know, and I don't know. I don't know if the police know, but I know. I believe he was charged with something or other, trespass.
Sure.
Among
it's
other
private
things.
Property.
Yeah. So he goes up there, and it seems like more and more people are doing this. You know, you see the people with those the helmet cams, those GoPro video helmet cams. It's sort of an invitation for people to do really dangerous stuff.
Maybe we should make GoPro helmet cams illegal.
Oh, there you go.
To stop people from doing stupid stuff.
Yeah.
But seriously, what about this, Casey, the stupid factor? In other words, how many laws do we need to have to stop people from doing stupid stuff?
Well, I don't think we really need to pass a law on this. You know, I mean, certainly it's wrong. And certainly he could be and probably will be charged with trespassing, right? This guy went on the Brooklyn Bridge.
Sure.
But isn't a more important question, how did he do it?
Yeah.
How did he get up there on the – what is it? The world's most traveled?
It'd be nice if that's what he's calling attention to, but unfortunately it's some sort of –
he's not.
Undermine, right. You know, it's some vague pot message by his silly name. That's what it is, you know. I'm the Reverend Bud Green, man, and look what we did.
Yeah, and he does look like a Reverend Bud Green.
Bud Green, right. Yeah. But let's talk about the Acuity guy. I know you already covered this in a past show.
No, but that's okay.
But I did want to chime in on that. you know, when the message becomes, look what foolish thing I can do. And you got to remember that people that own property that is an attractive nuisance, you know, the classic example is your swimming pool in the backyard and all the litigation that's happened over the years where you have to have sufficient lighting and warning for people that might be trespassing. Somebody who's actually breaking the law and ends up falling into your swimming pool that was dark and slippery and didn't have a fence around it can still sue you if you didn't take enough measure to allow somebody to, you know, even though they're doing something wrong, needs to know that there is a hazard present. So, you know, when you build a gigantic flagpole,
and let's point out
all the engineering involved with that and all the money spent doing that, it's presumed that you would very much like not to draw people to the flagpole so they go leaping off the top of it.
Well, I think there was like, if I recall correctly, there was like a crane next to it, and I think he got up via the crane. But the other thing I wanted to point out, just to be clear, is that I do not believe that this person who did this was an Acuity employee.
I don't believe that's the
case. I think it was just some guy.
Some guy
who did it and got up there somehow and decided to bungee jump and apparently came within like 5 feet of the ground.
So the message that he was apparently sending is, look what a kooky guy I am and what I can do. And I think we have an interest as a society in making those things illegal and to prosecute them, because it's not fair. Let me put it this way. It's not fair that there are legitimate issues that need to be discussed in a civilized forum that have to do with legalization of marijuana. And this goofball throws it off track. So now we're talking about how silly his name is, what he looks like, and what kind of stunt he pulled. And it's not drawing attention to the issue.
Right.
So, and the other guy who's just a thrill seeker, well, heck, you know, it makes sense that we have to have some form of law that discourages people from doing dumb stuff. I mean, really dumb stuff. It's dumb enough to do all the things that we all do, smoking cigarettes and drinking alcohol and all those other things that are perfectly legal, by the way.
Yeah.
But, you know, a law that says don't jump off a flagpole with a bungee cord is a perfectly reasonable law in my mind.
But how many of those are you going to have to do? I mean,
You know what? You'd think it would be a rare thing, but it keeps coming up.
It does keep coming up. And you know, this guy, I think he said something to the effect of, I think this was on the 4th of July, actually. He was talking about how, you know, God bless our troops and God bless America. And
so his real message was, wee! That was his message.
That was essentially the message. You know, and he was doing it in a patriotic way. I think he had a flag draped around him or something like that. It was,
you know,
I don't recall.
Who cares? That offends me. That offends me.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the flag is there to give you a sense of...
It's sacred.
Sacred, and it's part of our heritage. It's part of our national identity. It's something that, me in particular, I still get chills when I hear the national anthem, and I'm saluting the flag just because of... It's something that happens when you're serving the military.
You
just have this sense of pride in it. And to see some...
That's great.
To see some jerk wrapping himself up in a flag and jumping off the top of a flagpole, for heaven's sake. Or the Reverend Bud, who's bleaching the American flag. I mean, yeah, you did something stupid. We get it. We can see what you did.
Right.
You're a moron. Good day.
Well, Kirk, we're going to... Kirk is all revved up, so hopefully next week he'll be revved up again as well, as we always are.
Indeed.
And this
Indeed.
Is Legal Defense with Kirk and Casey. Remember, you can join us every Saturday from 8 to 9. Have a wonderful weekend.